Armando Perez versus the people of the state of Colorado. Could I have the entry of appearances, please? Counsel? Thanks very much. Before the people, please.
John Lee, on behalf of the people.
Now, this is an hour case, and each side has a half hour, as you all know. Ms. Vice, you will need to keep track of your own time, please. You can go ahead.
May it please the court, Dana Vice, on behalf of Mr. Perez with the Public Defender's Office. When a trial court improperly admits prior bad acts evidence, reversal is required unless the reviewing court can say with fair assurance that the error did not substantially influence the verdict or affect the fairness of the trial proceedings. That's what this court said in Newsom v. Peeble. And the state has not demonstrated, and it cannot demonstrate in this case, that the error of injecting highly prejudicial bad acts evidence did not influence the verdict or substantially affect the fairness of Mr. Perez's trial. At the core of this case is the fact that Mr. Perez's fundamental due process right to a fair trial by an impartial jury was whittled away by the prosecution's improper introduction of evidence that had no business in this case, which was used to paint Mr. Perez as a person with criminal propensity, and which the prosecutor argued could be used by the jury to infer that he was applying lessons that he had learned 4 years prior with these acts to prey on the victim in this case. Under these circumstances, Mr. Perez never had a chance at a fair trial. As we all know, admission of 404B evidence carries the risk of misuse by the jury to infer propensity or the bad character of the defendant. And that the prior 404B evidence in this case never should have come in the first place is not contested before this court. That's not the issue that's presented to this court. The Court of Appeals rightfully concluded that the evidence was improperly admitted. It erred when it concluded that only one of Mr. Perez's convictions needed to be reversed. Now, there are some contexts in which 404B evidence just is so prejudicial and the risk to the defendant's rights so great that admission of evidence of that evidence requires reversal. And that's precisely what we have in this case. There are four reasons that the improper admission of the evidence in this case requires reversal of all of Mr. Perez's convictions. One, all of the charges were based on the same incident in this case, and each contained a component of a sexual assault. Two, the prosecution urged the jury to consider the bad acts without limitation or beyond its limited purpose. Three, the limiting instruction in this case was ineffective. And four, this case was a closed case that did depend upon the credibility of the complaining witness in this case. I want to hit on the first reason, and that's that all of these charges were based on the same incident, and they all contain some component of a sexual assault allegation. There were three charges in this case. The first was sex assault on a child. The prosecution had to prove, for this count, that the defendant knowingly subjected CB to any sexual contact. The second count was kidnapping with the enhancing factor of a sexual assault. And the prosecution had to prove for that count that the defendant knowingly took, enticed, decoyed away CB with the intent to keep or conceal the child from her parents or guardians, and that during the commission of the offense, CB was the victim of a sexual offense. And finally, the third count was enticement of a child. And to prove that, the prosecution was required to prove that the defendant invited, persuaded, or attempted to invite or persuade CB to enter the vehicle with the intent to commit sexual assault or unlawful sexual contact. All of those involved a sexual component, and all were based on the same body of fact, the same transaction that was at issue in this case.
Vice, can I interrupt for a second? The Usom case that you cited, was that, was the 404B admitted in that for all counts or one count? I apologize, I don't recall.
It was just one count.
And it, was there just one count? So it wasn't sort of limited to a discrete count?
That's correct.
How would you articulate the difference between this situation where it was admitted for a limited purpose to that?
Well, it's interesting that we don't really have any cases that present this precise factual background where a court attempts to limit it to one count and not another. And my first position is that when you have evidence that's of such a prejudicial nature, meaning that the prior bad acts evidence is so inherently prejudicial just by the nature of the act itself, in this case it was stalking evidence, that there are some circumstances in some contexts that the jury is just not going to be able to put that out of their minds or even follow a limiting instruction. And I think that, that that's the case with Soto, that's the case with Usom. It was just improperly admitted in the first place, and it could not be used by the jury for any proper purpose. So I want to hit on the second
thing. Before you move on from that first point, how important is the nature of the charges all arising from the same acts, you say, or the same victim anyway. How important is that to your argument with regard to 404B requiring reversal at all counts?
Why it's important in this particular case is because each one required the sexual, or each of these counts required or had a sexual assault component. When you get to the limiting instruction, and I'll get to that in terms of the ineffectiveness of this particular limiting instruction that was given in this case, the jury was instructed that it could only consider the prior bad acts evidence as it related to Mr. Perez's intent to commit a sex assault on CB. That's what they were told. The second, or the sentence that immediately followed that, then purported to limit consideration of the evidence to only count number three, enticement of a child. So these two instructions, or those two sentences, were internally inconsistent, or the verdict, or excuse me, the limiting instruction in this case was internally inconsistent or contradictory. Additionally, another reason, and I'll just hit to number three since I'm on that topic. Additionally, the contemporaneous limiting instruction that was given orally before the 404B witness testified, it was not consistent with the written instruction as appeared in the jury instruction, the final written instruction. When the 404B witness testified, the trial court read to the jury the limited purpose, and again it said, you are instructed, you're about to hear prior acts evidence, you're only to consider it as it relates to Mr. Perez's intent to commit a sex assault on CB. So again, it did not limit it to the purpose or to the count three enticement charge. It encouraged that instruction itself, the oral contemporaneous limiting instruction, encouraged the jury to use it as it related to Mr. Perez's intent to commit a sex assault on CB. And each one of these counts involved a sex assault on CB.
Just ask one follow-up. If the rationale, if I understand it right, the thrust of your argument really, and other crimes evidence or uncharged criminal misconduct generally, is that the jury will be overcome with prejudice and not be able to follow their instruction and use it only for the purpose they're instructed. If that is true, why does it make any difference what the other charges are? Isn't the reason for a reversal of improper admission of other crimes evidence that the jury will hate the defendant and therefore rule against him for improper reasons?
I would agree with that statement, and there are cases that hold such in terms of, despite a limiting instruction, the jury just can't be presumed to follow it. That's the Goldsberry line of cases, that's Bruton, that comes up in other contexts like People v. Wilson outside the 404B context, and that also is Soto. So in that, I do believe that one bright line rule is that there are some circumstances in which the prejudicial nature of the 404B evidence is such that it requires just reversal of all convictions because it's so prejudicial, it injects that prejudice into the minds of the jurors and therefore all convictions need to be reversed. We do, however, have context in which, despite the risk of misuse of such 404B evidence, It can be properly admitted if it's properly admitted under the Spoto-Garner test with a proper limiting instruction, a carefully crafted limiting instruction. That's not what we have here, because the evidence itself was inadmissible. It was improperly admitted.
And so from your point of view, do you think an appropriate ruling, given your argument, would be for us to say, at least where all of the charges arise out of the same incident, and at least where, that it's improper, or that it's necessarily harmful and reversible?
Yes, under the circumstances of this case, certainly. You can still do that within the confines of Spoto, Garner test still exists. When evidence does come in under a proper purpose under the law, a limiting instruction can serve to limit the consideration when it's properly admitted in the first instance. A second rule can be that sometimes there are situations that present themselves where the evidence, the prior 404B evidence, is so prejudicial, we just have to acknowledge that it must prejudice the jury against the defendant. And a third rule, if that's what you're getting at, could be that in cases in which a trial court attempts to or improperly admits 404B evidence, and there are several charges in the case, and the trial court attempts to limit consideration of the evidence to only one count, that reversal is required under the same standard of Usum, which is where, unless the trial reviewing court is persuaded that the error did not influence the verdict or affect the fairness of the proceedings, and you can do that by looking at different factors, for example, the nature of the inadmissible evidence, again, considering the nature of the 404B evidence. You can do that by looking at the nature of the charges. Were the charges interrelated? Were they inextricably intertwined? Is there a risk that the jury could have improperly admitted or use the improperly admitted evidence as to each of those charges, given the charges themselves? You can look to written limiting instruction. Was it clear? Was it concise? Was it properly worded? Was it a carefully crafted limiting instruction? As this court has said, it must be under Usum, and many cases prior to that. You can look at the execution of the limiting instruction in the oral contemporaneously read instruction. Was that instruction consistent with the written instruction? Was it concise? Was it, did it adequately inform the jury of the proper purpose or the limited purpose? You can look at counsel's arguments. What did counsel do with the prior evidence? Did they expound upon it? Did they encourage the jury to use it beyond its limited purpose? Did they really focus a lot of their efforts in both closing and opening statements? And you can look at the strength or the strength of the case presented by the state. And you can go through all of those factors to determine under any given case whether you can state with fair assurance that the verdict was an influence or that the fairness of the trial proceedings were protected. And I think in this case, if you apply all of those factors I just went through, it weighs in favor of Mr. Perez, because the charges were all interrelated. They were interconnected. They were inextricably intertwined. They were all based on the same body of evidence. Because the limiting instruction here was confusing. It states that the jury should use it for as it related to Mr. Perez's intent to commit a sex assault on CB, when all of the charges related to that, and then told them to confine it to enticement of a child. It was inconsistent with the orally read contemporaneous instruction.
Ms. Weiss, can I stop you there? Because that's what I was going to ask. Tell me again, what was the verbal instruction, and where is that in the record? I apologize.
It's okay. That is on page 218 of the November 2nd transcript. And that was on the second day of testimony. That's right before the 404B witness testified. And let's see, it says, I'm going to instruct you further about the particular charges in this case, but I'm going to tell you now that one of those charges requires that the district attorney prove that Mr. Perez had a particular intent. They have to prove that he had the intent to commit sexual assault or unlawful sexual contact upon a child. Now, this evidence is coming in with this witness. It's only offered for the purpose of establishing what that intent was. It may not be used to show that he had a particular character or bad character, or that he acted in conformity therewith. So it did not confine it specifically or explicitly to the enticement on a child.
Let me ask you two other questions about it. Was there an objection to, I mean, I know there was an objection to the 404B in total. Was there an objection to the form of the limiting instruction or an objection to the verbal instruction?
There was not a contemporaneous objection is what I would grant to you. What there was at the beginning of this trial, defense counsel presented to the court their request that the district attorney be limited in how he was able to use this evidence, that the district or that the trial court instruct the prosecution not to, or for, to only use the, or argue the evidence as to its limited purpose. At that point, the trial court could not remember why it had admitted the evidence in this case, or what particular purpose under 404B. So he allowed the prosecution to argue in opening statements without limitation or without orienting the jury as to the limited purpose. Generally, the arguments that came out, which was that he was learning lessons from, you know, 4 years prior in preying on CB in this case. And then the second day of trial, the trial court had reviewed its previous ruling and determined it was for the limited purpose of that count three. At that point, the parties began discussing the instructions. The instructions that I just read to you is what the court read prior to the 404B witness. And then,
Was there an objection to that? Was there a, say, judge, you need a further objection, you need to further limit?
Not at that point in time. Then after the instruction conference, the parties again began talking about the limiting instruction that would be given. And at that point, the judge indicated that it was going to give a limited instruction that read, this evidence was admitted solely for the limited purpose of demonstrating such intent as it relates to count number three, enticement of a child. Unfortunately, it wasn't worded as such in the final written instructions. There was not an objection at that time with the final written instructions, other than the discussion that that was what was going to be the limited instruction, which unfortunately ended up not being worded in the same fashion.
And the record's unclear about how that happened?
Correct.
Okay, all right, thank you. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. With respect to the actual written instruction, and I have in front of me instruction number 7, is that the ultimate written instruction that was provided to the jury?
That's correct.
It does say, though, that at the time you were instructed not to consider it for any other purpose other than the limited purpose for which it was admitted. Is that actually incorrect based on what you, the transcript that you read to us?
At that time?
Yes.
My position is that it was not clear at that oral contemporaneous limiting instruction that was read to the jury prior to her testimony is not consistent with this. It was not limited specifically to the enticement charge.
Okay. Nonetheless, the written instruction does expressly limit it to count number three, enticement of a child. And then at the end also says you are again instructed you cannot consider evidence admitted for a limited purpose except for the limited purpose for which it was admitted. So we have a statement, it's limited to enticement, and by the way, don't use it for any other purpose, correct? And so what do we do, even taking into account the inconsistency with the paraverbal instruction, can we not give any sort of weight or credence to this written instruction and trust that the jury in fact followed this? In other words, let's say we all agree that the evidence here was improperly admitted for purposes of enticement. Why can't we rely on the instruction given to the jury here that they were only, that were boxed in to considering it only for charge three? Why do we must we assume when they are arguing that the prejudice leached into the other counts?
I think, again, for all of the reasons that I outlined in the briefing that I was just hitting on, that is that, first of all, it is internally inconsistent. When you tell lay people, the jury, to consider the evidence, unfortunately, every single one of those charges involved a sex assault, and then tell them only to confine it to that third, I don't think that that's a very clear instruction. It's inartfully worded. It doesn't give the clear a very carefully, or it doesn't give the jury a very carefully crafted and clear instruction as to the limited proper purpose for which they could consider the evidence. But aside from that, The evidence itself was incredibly prejudicial. It was stalking behavior. They presented a witness during this 1.5-day trial that took over 22 pages of testimony at trial, going on and on about this prior incident 4 years prior. In addition to that, I think that the fact that the jury the inconsistency within the written instruction, the inconsistency with the orally read instruction, and you also have the prosecutor who came out the gates talking about this, this prior evidence, saying that he was applying lessons he learned back 4 years prior, that you'll hear that she was able to protect herself before, she was able to prevent any unwanted sexual contact from happening. But then in this case, he took those lessons and he applied them to CB and made sure that she was alone so that he could do what he wanted with her. And there was no prior sex assault allegation in that prior case, the prior 404B evidence at all. There was no allegation of any unwanted sexual contact, any attempted unwanted sexual contact, any sex assault, any attempted sex assault, nothing of that nature. And yet it was portrayed by the prosecutor who took liberties at mischaracterizing what that evidence was and told the jury that they could consider it specifically as it related to this predatory kind of picture that he was painting of Mr. Perez, both in openings before the jury had been oriented or told what to limit their consideration of this evidence to, and also in closing arguments, when he also did the same thing and told them that they could use it to consider if he was applying lessons from 4 years prior, and explicitly in his rebuttal said in the context of the SAOC charge, the sex assault on a child charge, that they could consider this evidence. And so when you have all of those factors together, there's just no way that a reviewing court can say with fair assurance that that prejudicial evidence that comprised a significant portion of this trial did not substantially influence the verdict or affect the fairness.
Assume for a moment that we're inclined to look at this the way you're suggesting, but we want to more succinctly state a very narrow holding. How would you do that if we weren't inclined to talk about many factors and set up something that, who knows, might come back to haunt us one day in some fashion, in a factual situation that we can't even fully contemplate right now? How would you very succinctly state the holding that you're suggesting?
I think that in a case where the evidence is not overwhelming, where it's dependent upon the credibility of witnesses, and where a limiting instruction is defective or is not carefully crafted and executed in the case, when improperly admitted evidence gets or comes in at trial, reversal of all counts when that limiting instruction did not work is required.
So, just to follow up on that, so your rule would require the presence of all four of those things?
Not necessarily. I think that in this case, personally, it can be resolved just by looking at the nature of the prejudicial evidence. It was improperly admitted. That question is not before this court. When you have improperly admitted 404B evidence or prior bad acts evidence, and it's of such a nature that it is so egregious and prejudicial, it requires reversal of all convictions. Despite a limiting instruction, even though it was improperly worded. But despite any limiting instruction, I think that the court can so hold, and that would be a very, succinct way to resolve the case without going into the factors. But I do think that the court can also consider the fact that in particular circumstances where you have all of these factors weighing against fair assurance that a defendant's rights are protected, that reversal is required. If there are no further questions, I'd like to save the rest of my time for you.
You may do so. Mr. Lee?
Thank you, and may it please the court, John Lee on behalf of the people. To decide this case, this court can only find one principle. Because there's no evidence in the contrary, this court should presume that the jury followed the trial court's limiting instruction. Time and again, this court has applied that very same presumption.
Counsel, can I just ask you right off of that, does the presumption apply? And this is a little bit of a gloss on your opposing counsel's argument, but isn't this, in this case, the court says, you know, this is good evidence. I'm admitting the evidence, but I'm, then it has a sensitivity about the limited purpose. But the premise is this is good evidence, and now you don't contest that it was bad evidence, correct? So does the presumption still apply in that circumstance?
It does, and I think that's a great place to start, because petitioner's argument kind of rests on the facts and the threshold legal premise that this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have found that there's kind of a cardinal rule to this presumption, that if there's inherently prejudicial evidence, we can determine that the presumption does not apply, and that it applies to any kind of inherently prejudicial evidence. We believe the case suggests otherwise, and in fact, I think as this court has found, it really only applies in one instance. The language where it comes from is from the U.S. Supreme Court case, and although there was broad language dealing with the U.S. Supreme Court's distrust of juries, well, although the language was broad, there are some very important limitations in that case. The first one being, as we pointed out in the brief, that they did not find that the limiting instruction was not sufficient to justify the prejudice. It was that the limiting instruction given in that case was not sufficient to protect the defendant's constitutional right of confrontation. So in that case, we're dealing with a constitutional confrontation problem. But more importantly, I think the bigger limitation is what we learn when the U.S. Supreme Court comes back and clarifies what they meant in Richardson almost 20 years later. And in Richardson, what the Supreme Court, what the U.S. Supreme Court found, and what this court expressly said in Quest at 1090 is, Richardson limited Bruton to its specific facts. And the old and specific facts of Bruton were just, if there are two co-defendants at trial, and you admit one of the co-defendants' admission to the crime, inculpating the other defendants, then we cannot presume that the jury could use it to that one co-defendant, but not use it against the other co-defendants. And I think if we compare, so that's what they said in Bruton was not okay. But when we look at Richardson, when they say, okay, if we just change the facts just a little bit, we're going to say the presumption does apply, because that presumption only goes away for that one specific instance, I think it highlights that it really only goes to that one specific factual instance. Because in Richardson, the only difference was there was still an incriminating admission of the co-defendant's confession against the defendant, but it wasn't directly inculpating. It was only inferentially.
So you want us to hold essentially that jurors will always follow instructions except for this extremely narrow carve-out that you've, how you've defined it.
That would definitely be one way, yes. And I would say that I believe that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that, and I think this court said almost as much as Quest. If it didn't want to go quite that far, I would say that, at least as far as the facts we have in this case, cases both 4-4B and Richardson go a step further than what we're asking for in this case, and what the trial court asked from the jury to do with the limiting instruction. Because again, in Richardson, you had a case where they're allowed to consider evidence completely against one co-defendant, whether he committed the crimes of murder and assault with the other co-defendants. But if it's not directly inferential, we can assume that the jury could only look at that kind of evidence against that defendant, but not against the other co-defendants. Here, I think the facts are far more separated. We have, there are some elements for each of the crimes. I think that they're temporally distinct, because we have the crime outside the car to get the victim inside the car, and then we have what were the crimes that occurred inside the car.
Could I follow up on that?
Yes.
Along the same lines, I guess it's hard to articulate exactly, but it does seem in this area of other crimes evidence, you have an unusual situation in which the very reason that we would reverse for improperly balancing prejudice and probativeness is that the jury won't be able to follow their instructions, and they won't be able to limit their consideration to the thing that the court says they can limit it to, but rather they will consider the bad character of the defendant and therefore will punish him for an improper reason. Is that wrong? And if that is true, then haven't we in this area simply said we're not going to presume that they follow their instruction, but that they can't follow their instruction?
And I would disagree that that is what this court found in those other cases, respectfully. The problem in Deesum and in Sfoto was not that the jury was unable to follow the limiting instruction. It was that there was really no limiting instruction given. In Deesum, the issue was because the limiting instruction said you can consider it only for the purpose and to refute the claim of self-defense, that the only way the evidence could have been relevant is if the jury used it for character. There was not the separate language that we have in this case, which is not only is it for a limited purpose, but she can't use it for character and you can't use it for purpose.
And admittedly, there are cases in which the problem with the 404B evidence is something different. Failure to make the preliminary determination under 104 that's required, failure to structure the instruction properly. But where, and I took it that was the case here, where it is found that this just shouldn't have come in under the balance of probativeness and prejudice, the 403 part of that. And we've said in Spoto, we've even included, maybe gratuitously, but at least to emphasize, this has to be independent of an inference of bad character. Isn't it the case that the reason we're reversing for making that balance, that improper determination with regard to the balance, is that the jury will be influenced by the prejudicial aspects?
It is, but again, with the important limitation of the instruction in Spoto allow the jury to consider for character. Although they did use the term limiting instruction, if we look at the instruction that was given in Spoto, there really is no limit. It's more of an emphasizing instruction. You can consider this evidence for the limited purpose of motive and nothing else. But it doesn't say that you can't consider for character and you can't consider for propensity. So I think that is a critical legal distinction between those cases and this case. And I do think that is what this court was trying to say in both Usam and Spoto. It's not that the jury could not follow the limiting instruction. It's the limiting instruction that was given really did have no limit. And the evidence that was limited because it was prejudicial. And I think both cases make clear that the jury did consider the evidence for character in both cases, that's why the convictions in those cases had to be reversed. And I would also like to make the point that in this case, the Court of Appeals did not find that the evidence was not admissible under the third prong of Spoto. It was the fourth. So it was the 403 balancing test, that this evidence has very little, if any, marginal relevance to the case. There's not a way for it to stand for unfair prejudice. So even disregarding the legal distinction on Usam's Spoto, which I do believe is correct, this case would still be different because, unlike Usam's Spoto, the evidence was not inherently prejudicial to those two cases. The evidence was largely irrelevant, and I think that's why the Court of Appeals found that it should not have been admitted. Not that because it just had such a dangerous character inference. Because I think if you think of those cases, and kind of this court explained in that, to the extent of the charges that remain, those required completed crimes. The other evidence, apart from not really being evidence of any crime, there was no completed act. So to the extent it had any relevance to show character propensity, there wasn't very much. The fact that he had not done anything before shows us very little of what he then later charged with doing.
Except that, I mean, on balance, the point, as I understood the Court of Appeals, was it's limited because it had such little probative value. It was therefore the creep factor. Because it had such a limited probative value, it was therefore substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effects. In other words, you're saying not completed act in the earlier incident. The whole point, though, was that he came off looking just sort of like a creepy stalker kind of person. And that's the prejudicial effect that the court was worried about. Why do we assume that that didn't invade all aspects of all the charges being considered?
Two reasons. One, the limiting instruction. They were expressly told, you can't consider propensity, you can't consider for character. Two, the elements of the crime are very different in this case. And I guess I would like to look at instruction because I think the argument that's being raised is that all three crimes share the same elements. They didn't. The enticement charge was the only one that required the intent to commit sexual assault. And again, that was temporarily distinct because that is what happened outside the car. The issue of the other two crimes where the convictions do remain are what happened inside the car. And neither one of those crimes requires an intent. In order to be convicted of sexual assault, you just had to knowingly engage in sexual contact. In order to be convicted of kidnapping, you had to knowingly intend to conceal or hide the victim from their parents. And also going back to our opinion to address your question more directly, I do think it's interesting that the primary ground, I'd say, that the Court of Appeals relied on from prejudice hasn't actually really been addressed today. And I think if you look at the Court of Appeals opinion, their concern was, although they found the evidence to be of little relevance, is they were concerned because they thought the facts were close in regards to whether or not there was consent. They thought that, and I think they put that in their sentence in the paragraph, where the court was discussing that the jury could have made some evidence that the victim consensually got in the car and consensually had sexual contact with the victim in exchange for drugs. And that's an important distinction here, because for the crimes of sexual assault and kidnapping, consent is certainly not an offense. So I guess I would distinguish the other two crimes that there's a pretty broad line separating these two convictions from the other conviction on those grounds.
But again, I think that seems, your argument seems to assume that the jury might have used that 404B evidence for its limited probative value as it related to the other charges. And I guess I'm not sure or convinced that that's the right question. To me, the right question is whether we need to be concerned about the prejudicial value or the prejudicial impact of that evidence invaded or infiltrated their consideration of the other charges, as opposed to did that show or allow the jury to conclude that the prosecution had its burden of proof with respect to the other charges. I think, aren't we concerned about the prejudicial effect?
Okay, and I guess the way that I was trying to answer the question was the prejudicial effect, I think, because the Court of Appeals was that they could, to the extent this case turned on slight credibility determinations, was whether or not there's consent or not. So to the extent the jury used the 404B evidence to find that the victim did not consent, then it could have prejudiced the enticement charge, but it would not have prejudiced the kidnapping and the sexual assault charge. And I guess in addition to just, you know, these logical arguments, I think the jury's verdicts actually tell us otherwise, because they acquitted the defendant of sexual assault involving threats, and the victim of the lesser just sexual assault without threats.
Don't all these mental gymnastics seem to elevate form over substance? Ultimately, talk to me about how jurors are likely to form an impression of a defendant. How could this not result in the kind of leeching to which Justice Marquez alluded? How can it not result in the unfair inference of propensity to which Justice Coates alluded?
Practically, I think it kind of turns on the framework of how juries decide cases and how the system is designed for them to decide cases. So it's not what you think the defendant did, it is did we the people prove it beyond reasonable doubt under these instructions and under these general evidence laws that we do. So when you're dealing with separate crimes, I think it is entirely possible for the jury to follow instructions and say, we can look at all of these tons of evidence and separate this crime. And whether people prove that beyond reasonable doubt. Okay, so these other two elements, whether people have proved beyond reasonable doubt, all of these elements, we have caught out this one piece, this one thing about this, but consider all the rest. Did the people do it? I think that's entirely possible. Apart from pragmatics, again, as I said, I think this court is largely a found that the jury has. I mean, that is why we have limiting instructions. I mean, 404B itself allows the jury to consider potential character evidence for one aspect, but not for character. And we've already made that determination. As I pointed to earlier, I think Richardson goes far further than what we asked the jury to do in this case. In addition, I think just as a policy matter, it's something that this court has and should continue to do. Trust juries, and also, as I think there's a good discussion in Richardson, just as a matter of judicial economy, that case being the potential prejudice for the Bruton line of error could be just a whole set of trial for the co-defendants. But the U.S. Supreme Court found that that was too great a cost. If we just give them one instruction and it's not directly incriminating, then we can trust the jury to follow it. And I think that certainly would apply in this case, that rather than charging the defendant separately in all the cases, the better practice is to charge him in one case and just give the jury the limiting instruction. Did this court have no further questions?
Doesn't appear so, thank you.
Thank you.
To touch on a couple of things. Justice Marquez, you asked about the prejudicial impact. And I do want to note that for all of the cases that say that we presume the jury's followed instructions, we also have a line of cases that were cited in my briefing as well, which acknowledge that sometimes the coaches disagree. And they use language establishing, you have to acknowledge the damning innuendo that admission of this type of highly prejudicial evidence has on the minds of the jurors. You hear it in the language when they use phrases such as, a drop of ink cannot be removed from a glass of milk, or one cannot unring a bell, or if you throw a skunk in the jury box, you can't instruct the jury not to smell it. All of these colorful metaphors are designed to capture the serious imprint that such prejudicial evidence can have on the minds of the jurors.
And so let me interrupt you right there, because I'm thinking in a perhaps slightly different context. Let's say a witness inadvertently gives testimony that everybody has already agreed was not supposed to come in, mm-hmm. right? And the court then gives a contemporaneous curative instruction instructing a jury to disregard that inadmissible evidence. Isn't that sort of just a different version of what we have going on here? We have the jury instructed, don't pay attention to this evidence for purposes of these other charges.
I don't think that it's that simple, and we certainly do have those cases where there's inadvertent evidence that comes out, the jury is strongly and carefully with limiting instruction or curative instruction is told to disregard it and not consider that evidence for any purpose whatsoever. Those cases are distinguishable based on those facts alone. Usually that evidence is very, very minor in the case. It's quickly dealt with, and it's dealt with a very careful limiting or curative instruction, instructing the jury not to use for any purpose. That's not what we have here. It's very much distinguishable given all of the reasons, the four reasons that I said, that require reversal in this particular case. And I would also note, I want to hit on the fact that, I'll lead into the fact that Justice Hood, you mentioned the form over substance. Isn't this form over substance essentially in terms of what is the jury really doing with this evidence? And I think that most people know that juries are definitely forming opinions. In fact, in Winkelried, which I cited in my briefing as well, indicates that most of the available psychological studies confirm that jurors tend to form a unified, integrated impression of the defendant. And it makes it very difficult, given that, for jurors to follow limiting instructions and segregate the proper and improper views, even when properly instructed. And here, we did not have a proper limiting instruction. It wasn't sufficient. It wasn't strong enough. It told the jury to consider the evidence. And that evidence was ultimately determined to be improperly admitted. I also want to hit on the Richardson v. Marsh case, because that case basically did distinguish itself from Bruton. It still upheld the Bruton principle, but it also said that Bruton applies when evidence expressly implicates the defendant and is incriminatory on its face. Now, of course, this is in the context of the co-defendant's testimony implicating the defendant, allegedly. But that being the distinction between Richardson v. Marsh is that the evidence itself in Richardson was redacted all references to the defendant, because the defendant in Richardson v. Marsh. And so the fact that the court distinguished itself from Bruton is still upheld the Bruton principle that when evidence on its face is incriminatory and it implicates the defendant, it requires reversal of all. So that is a distinction that I wanted to hit on with Richardson v. Marsh. And I also wanted to address that I would disagree with the characterization of Spoto and Newsom, in that Spoto explicitly stated, this court explicitly stated in Spoto, that the potential for prejudice in this case was overwhelming. And that is why they reversed in this case. That oracle of the evidence was too prejudicial. It required reversal, despite the limited instruction that did limit the consideration.
Well, the way the prosecution opened and closed the arguments had to do with trying those events rather than this one. It sure seemed like the whole case was built around that.
It centered on the 404B evidence, correct.
How many times have you seen a trial judge do what's happened here, even in the basic sense of saying, here is 404B evidence that you're to consider as to a single count but no other counts? Put aside all the other problems.
I was not able to find any cases that dealt with this particular factual circumstance in this case, specifically where it purported to limit it to one count when there were several, and then it was found to be improperly admitted and of the nature that it was in this case.
Would it be fair to characterize this case as an outlier then?
Unfortunately, it's unusual. I was not able to find any cases that dealt with this precise situation. So in that sense, it is an outlier.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I don't know that I can answer that. I think that, again, it's because of the four specific circumstances of this case that I hit on that demand that this case, all of his convictions be reversed, based on just the improper instruction, that it was inconsistent, that it should never have come in the first place, that it was all of the facts that lead back to why we stand here today.
Since you didn't cite it, I presume in Winkle Reed didn't have a section on this.
I did not find anything specifically. And with that, I would ask the court to, Mr. Perez respectfully request this court to reverse the Court of Appeals opinion, reversing only one of his convictions, and that this court reverse all of his convictions.
Okay, thank you very much for your argument, Ms. Weiss. And you as well, Mr. Lee? The case will stand submitted. Our next case is until 2:30, so I guess we better take a little recess.